Hello and welcome to the Undead Wookiee podcast, episode 69, Jacob's Ladder from 1990. The Undead Wookiee is a fortnightly-ish podcast focusing on horror and sci-fi, but there will be times where we dip into other genres because here at the Undead Wookiee, our nerdiness knows no bounds. Hello and welcome back. I am your host, as always, Hugh Lloyd. And like I said, we are looking at one of my all-time favourite films, Jacob's Ladder from 1990. Now, before I introduce my very, very special co-host, let's check out the trailer.
Every day, Jacob Singer goes to work.
What's wrong?
It's one of those days.
And every day, he wonders what is happening to him.
Maybe it's the pressure, Jake.
They're like demons, Jess. They weren't human.
What were they, Jake?
Let me look at your hand.
You have a very strange line.
See, according to this, you're already dead.
Something's wrong, Jake. They're coming after me. I don't know who they are or what they are, but they're gonna get me, and I'm scared, Jake.
I've seen them too.
Maybe the demons are real.
He's running 106 feet.
This is barbaric.
I can get rid of the demons.
Who are you?
I can block the ladder.
Who are you?
Where are you taking me? Where am I?
Where do you want to go?
Home.
This is your home. You're dead.
I'm not dead.
What are you then?
I'm alive.
And we are back, ladies and gentlemen. And we waited a very long time, and just like a bus, two almost in a row. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together, jangle your jewelry, stamp your feet. Welcome back, Mr. Darren Hall. Darren, how the devil are you, sir?
I'm very well, sir. How are you?
I'm all right, yeah, I'm good. I love the pretense that we just haven't been talking for the best part of 15 minutes before we started recording.
I have not been talking. I've been washing my hands.
Yes, yes. In fact, I got to be honest, and this is going to sound really odd, my hands are all like quite raw now.
Yes, I think everyone in the country has slightly sore hands.
Yes, yes, but keep washing them.
Yeah, keep clean, people.
Yes, so important at the moment in time. Now, of course, we are talking one of my personal favourites, and I'm so glad that we got a chance to come back and revisit this. We are talking Jacob's Ladder from 1990.
Oh, I watched the 2019 one.
Oh, man, you're a braver man than I.
I did not. I steered well clear of that one.
Now, I'm not an anti-remake person in any way, shape or form, but there are some things that make you just go, why?
Yeah, absolutely. Robocop had me baffled. Yeah. Absolutely baffled.
Yeah. Poltergeist.
Yeah. Why, oh, why? Total Recall. Oh, we could go on.
Yes. Anyway. But here we are. We are talking. Adrian Lynn directed this one. It was written by Bruce Joel Rubin. It starred Tim Robbins as Jacob. The late, sadly, Elizabeth Peña. And the late Danny Aiello. Matt Craven. Pruitt Taylor Vince, who's a great actor. He's a superb actor.
Yeah.
Jason Alexander pops up in this. You got Eric Lachelle.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Vin Rames, Brian Tarantino, Anthony Alessandro. You've also got, in an uncredited role in one of his first outings, is Macaulay Culkin.
Yes, yes, I did notice. Which, the little scamp.
The scamp, yes.
Yeah.
Now, I'd sort of watched this back in the day, and lots of it sort of passed me by, but it had a massive impact on me. And if you think, if we just take this story on face value, it's quite a, you know, it's quite a simple story. It's the idea of a man who's haunted by something that happened whilst he was a soldier in Vietnam, and is he going mad? Is he, you know, has he been experimented on? You don't quite know. But then, as sort of rewatching it today, you find there are so many layers to this film.
Absolutely. I am, as you know, this was my first watch.
Yeah.
This has been on my radar for ages. Obviously, I've heard people talk about it a lot in my film discussions. It's just one of those that never quite got it into the DVD player.
Yeah.
Until you suggested we did it on the pod.
Yes.
And I didn't do any reading up on this or any trailers or anything like that. It was completely blind. So when it started off with that, you know, that amazing orange hue, the choppers flying over.
Yeah.
I just think, you know, you're fooled into thinking this is another Vietnam action and PST.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, film, but it's so much more than that.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, you know, let's sort of, you know, Adrian Lin, this is the guy who brought us Flashdance.
Yeah.
And, great. You know, great film. Don't get me wrong. It's a great film. Yeah. Fatal Attraction.
Yeah.
Another great film. But this is a completely different animal.
Yeah.
This is a completely different animal. And that opening scene, where they're all together in the jungle and what have you, it could, you know, could, like you said, very easily be something from Platoon.
Yeah, absolutely. It starts off with that, the banter's going on.
Yeah.
You know, they scramble to action. You know, there's, you know, the whole someone's in there coming behind the behind enemy lines, you know, scramble. I think it's so clever how it's just it purposely gives you that Nam movie feel.
Yes.
And it's just to fool you, it's to draw you in. You know what am I getting into here? You know, it's familiar territory.
Yeah.
I feel comfortable with this, you know, I know where this is going.
Yeah.
But you really, really don't.
And what I love about this is where it goes back to the, and I mean, the colouring and the lighting in this film is just, it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And I love the fact that when he goes back to Vietnam, the colours are warm.
Yeah.
It's warm. It feels warm. And then you go to New York.
Yeah.
Because obviously what happens is he gets bayoneted, and then he wakes up and he's in New York. He's on the subway, and the colours are muted.
Yeah, yeah. And I have a real soft spot for movies with like 1970s New York. I just think that there's something about the way New York looked then that works on film so well.
Yeah, yeah. It is cinematic, isn't it? By its very, very nature, it's cinematic.
Yeah.
And almost straight away, you get something's not right. Because he walked past that homeless person. And I remember seeing it when I was younger, and it creeped me out no end. The fact there's a tentacle.
Yeah. Yeah, that curls away when he notices it.
Yeah,
it's
and
very odd.
You just don't quite notice, you just don't see, and he just sort of like slithers away. And then he's trapped. He's trapped in the station and he's underground. And it's an amazing scene. It's an absolutely amazing scene.
Yeah, and it's just give you like an insight of how quickly this pulled me in. When he goes down to cross the tracks.
Yes.
I'm shouting at the screen, get off the tracks.
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing? And that's what, we're 10 minutes in by then.
Yeah.
I'm already invested in him now, 10 minutes in.
Now, Tim Robbins is the lead in this. Now, everybody sort of now automatically jumps, as we were talking beforehand, automatically jumps to Shawshank Redemption. But before this, Tim Robbins was known for comedy.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, of course, he'd done Howard the Duck. He'd done Bull Durham.
Yeah.
He was known for doing these sort of slightly offbeat, a little bit gaudy.
Yeah.
Kind of characters.
Lighthearted stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And, Cadillac Man. He was Eric the Viking. You got Bull Durham, you got you'd appear on Saturday Night Live, in skits, those kind of things. Very small role in Top Gun.
Really?
He plays Merlin in Top Gun.
Oh, does it? I've never made that connection.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
And he talks about Jacob's Ladder as being a turning point in his career, so that he could show that he could do something different.
Oh, he's fantastic in it.
And he is. He's absolutely superb. And he's so... And I think this is something as well with the entire cast, is they are so believable.
Oh, 100%. I've got that down in my notes, is, the realism that they managed to convey in those realistic scenes. So when we get away from all the madness that's going on.
Yeah.
And it's when he's with his girlfriend
Jezebel,
yeah, Jezzy. Those scenes, that's just everyday life. That's just a couple dealing with he's got an ex-wife, he's got children.
Yeah,
this is a newish relationship. They met at work, and it's a slice of their life that we're watching, and it feels like you're watching somebody's life. It's so realistic. It's so well done.
Yeah, yeah. And even when you get into the fantastical elements of it, you don't get the sense initially of the fantastical element. You instantly get the horror elements to it.
Yeah.
But actually, are you watching somebody's mind unravel as it's going?
Yeah.
And you can see straight away that he is a very, very damaged, broken person.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about, because I would go as far to say that this movie is genre-defining.
Oh, completely.
And given that I've watched this late in the day, what I'm watching is, my opinion is coloured by other things that I've watched that this movie probably influenced. So... And I'm kind of being pulled. So when anything is happening to him, like the hallucinations or whatever they are, I'm just pulled into that. Well, this is PTSD.
Yeah.
It's the effects of the drugs from, the chemicals from NAM.
Yeah.
Because we've seen all that before.
Yeah.
So, and I wonder what people watching this like, when it came out in the cinema, wonder what their take on it was, because it would be completely different because they wouldn't have seen anything like this before.
I mean, my first exposure to this, and I think this kind of speaks to my love of trailers, is that when, can you remember when Sky first started?
Yeah.
They would have the UK and the US top 10 box office.
Yeah, yeah.
So you'd have some of my favourite trailers are from that period. So in 1990, you had The Exorcist 3 came out.
Yeah.
And then this came out as well. And I remember seeing them because obviously Sky Movies, there was only one movie channel, and then it went to three, which was oh my God, this is incredible. But they had a lot of airtime to fill. So they would replay these, the top tens and those kind of things. So you'd get to see the trailers over and over again. And I remember being shit scared of this. And seeing just the glimpses of the horror.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that people possibly going back and looking at it now, they'll probably just, they'd not not get how genre defining that is.
Yeah.
In this film. Because even from that first scene where he steps on the subway and he drives past, and then that figure, that faceless figure, is waving to him as the train as the train goes past. It's just,
it's creepy.
It's, you know, and we, you know, we're 10 minutes in and already he's seeing tentacles on people and faceless you know, figures waving to him. It's just, you know, it's incredible. It's just so, you know, already, like you said, you're in his world.
It's quite impressive as well, because a lot happens and there's a lot of mad shit going on.
Yes.
But it never feels like the film is rushing along.
Which
I think is really, you know, really clever of the team, you know, that put this film together. Because it's, that keeps you invested.
Yeah.
Because it keeps you, I found that my mind was ticking over the whole time I was watching this. I wasn't traveling through it A to B.
You know,
my thoughts were spiraling, all over while it was happening to him.
But then you can kind of look at this film and it's sort of, you know, in terms of sort of diving into like the sort of the thematic elements to this film, you can dive in there, and you know, you could, like you said, you can look at this from the idea of it being a straight up sort of post Vietnam PTSD kind of film, but on another level, this is a film about disconnection.
Yeah,
it's about a generation of people, a generation of young men who are totally disconnected from their homes, from their own mental well-being, from their families. And in this case, you know, in terms of like Jacob's trauma, you know, his son Gabe had died. You know, and he's sort of dealing with the grief of that. He's dealing with the grief of the breakup of his marriage. He's dealing with what happened to him whilst he was, you know, away at war. He's living in New York, which in the 70s was a complete, you know, which in itself was like a war zone.
Yeah, yeah. He's also incredibly guilty about his relationship.
Yeah.
With Jesse.
Yes. And again, you know, and we can get into the sort of more sort of the biblical elements of this.
Yeah.
And like the idea that Jacob's ladder itself is, you know, sort of, you know, put it bluntly, is like, it's almost like a conduit for which angels would travel, between the sort of ethereal and the mortal realm and those kind of things, and sort of slipping through. And it's that idea that he is slipping, you know, he is at the bottom of that ladder.
And it does kind of open up the thought process that demons and angels are about us.
Yes.
Here on Earth, and you kind of transition from hell to heaven and back and forth with your actions whilst here on Earth, which I thought was, you know, incredibly deep. If you wanna take this film that way, but that's the beauty of this film, is, you know, take it as you want. There's multiple ways, you know, you could absorb this film.
And I mean, like, you look at Danny Aiello's character, the chiropractor, and actually, in the, you know, he is, it's only watching it this time round, really, that, and sort of, you know, just sort of doing some, you know, over the years I've read loads about, because it's one of my friends going back and reading it, and, you know, about this film, he talks about Meister Eckhart, who's the German philosopher. And he talks about that sort of Eckhart saw hell, and that the only thing that burns in hell is the part of you that won't let go of life, your memories, your attachments. So they burn them all away, but they're not punishing you. He said this, so they're free, you know, this idea that they're freeing your soul. And then we get the scene where Jesse is burning his pictures.
Yeah.
Of his children, of his family, of his past life, of all of these things. So it's like, even though it's, you know, and it's never revisited after that moment, nothing's ever made of it, because, you know, he doesn't ask about them. He doesn't think about them. The only photo that he carries with him is Gabe's photo.
Yeah.
which is almost like throughout the thing, the one thing that tethers him.
Yeah,
is Gabe.
Is the guilt.
Is the guilt.
The guilt of his accident is what is. It's kind of like it's the chain, isn't it? So Gabe dies in an accident. He goes to Vietnam. He comes back from Vietnam and doesn't pick up with his wife again. He moves in with Jesse. And it's like the chain of events anchors him. And he kind of has to decide whether he's going to, what he's going to let go of.
Yeah.
But I just love how it keeps you guessing, this film.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's, you know, the other thing you could look at it is, you know, it's a film about fear.
Yeah.
You know, it's the fear of death. It's the fear of being trapped. It's the fear of people around you dying. The fear of the unknown. You know, guilt. Will you, you know, the idea of, you know, do your sins catch up with you at some point? All of those things.
I like how it toys with you, because it's kind of like you sit there, you can go down there. This is the PTSD, Vietnam vet, angle. You can take that. That can be your journey through this movie, but it isn't that. It has very little to do with it. When you get through to the end,
yes,
you know, the Vietnam element and the testing and that has very little to do with the story.
Yeah.
But it just toys with you. It just keeps drawing. So he meets up with his old mates.
Yeah.
And you're like, and they're all, you know, brilliant scene when he's talking about what his friend who got blown up in the car.
Yeah.
What he talked about, why he was afraid and what he was seeing.
Yes.
And as the other guy, he's just stood at the door and you see a tear run down his cheek.
Yeah. 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 And I mean,
it's
like,
just so cool. Such a cool scene, that, because you could blink and you miss it.
Absolutely. And the thing is, those guys in that room are like men's men.
Yeah.
They are all, they're clearly all very, very rough, tough alpha men. And, you know, there's something about the 70s, isn't there? That actually, there's sort of ultra machismo kind of sort of thing going on there.
Yeah.
And like even seeing like Vin Rames' hand when he's shaking.
Yeah.
And he drops that beer bottle. And I mean, like, from, you know, in that opening scene where you've got like Paul, like the character whose car blows up, played by Pruitt Taylor Vince, who I think is an amazing actor.
Yeah.
He's an amazing actor. I loved him in, what was it called? Oh, the heavy metal horror one. Devil's Candy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I loved him in Devil's Candy. I thought he was just immense. Absolutely immense in that. But that scene where it's all going off around them and he sat there just watching everything in that opening scene and just frozen, but just crying.
Clear mental breakdown right there.
I think if you'd listened harder, you could hear the snap. And then he sort of, you know, and then that scene between him and Tim Robbins where they sat in the pool hall.
Yeah.
And that's, and again, it's so well lit. It's so well lit, that scene. It's just amazing. It is amazing. See, and that's the one thing that I, you know, I caught, my wife was laughing at me going on about the lighting in it. And just sort of say, this is just so well lit. And it's so well shot, because lots of this is talking.
Yeah.
But the camera's always moving. It's almost floating. It's absolutely superb. And the scene where we get, you know, when he attends the family, like the party.
Oh yeah, I did put a note though about whenever you see a party on a film, it just always makes me laugh, because there's nobody has parties like that.
No. Usually everybody's stood in the kitchen.
Yeah. You know, looking for the pork pies.
Yeah. You know, studying the beige buffet. It's
yeah.
And like, obviously, then, you know, it's, you know, he starts looking at Jezebel dancing, and again, yeah. it's that sort of, again, it's the that biblical nod, isn't it? And where she's clearly having some fun with some other kind of demon.
Yeah, a bit of demon love going on.
Yes.
It's really, again, though, the lighting and the way that it's shot.
Yes.
It's just fantastic because it builds up so it's such a quick scene.
Yeah.
But the build up is, you know, it's compartmentalized, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Between him and then what's going on, and then you're still then drawn back to, well, he's just going nuts. This isn't happening.
No.
Was my reaction to it. He's just seeing things.
Yeah, it's you know he's running a fever. It's a reaction to sort of whatever they've done to him. You know, because I mean, even like that scene where suddenly she realizes there's something wrong with him, and they put him in the bathtub and they're holding him in there and he's screaming.
Yeah.
And then you get the silence and he's just floating
in
the bath with the tears running down his face. Is, you know, again, it's that sort of, is he dead? Is he, you know, where is he? Because he always has the flashbacks, doesn't he?
You never know where he is. That I really like that part of the film because, one, when they're getting him in the bath, I love the sense of community of getting the ice, which is back to that realism. It was just like you go from that, you've got that demon scene.
Yes.
Completely bizarre, crazy, all over the place. Get back home, normality and shoes.
Yes.
And it's just so well done. It's just like, oh, this is the community, you know, everyone who lives in the apartment block rallying together to get him cooled down, and that the transition from complete nuts to everyday life.
Yeah,
you just can't ignore that as excellent filmmaking.
Yeah, and I think Elizabeth Peña as his girlfriend is superb.
Yeah,
she sort of veers between being really dislikable and just a normal person.
Yeah, you can see her patience wear thin as time goes by, which is so understandable.
Yeah.
And the line where she says, you know, I'm sick of men going mad around me.
Yes.
I'm not going to do it anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, she's sort of, and there's the other sort of biblical nod in the fact that she doesn't wear an awful lot of clothing.
No, she doesn't like clothes.
No, she's very warm.
Very warm, very warm.
It's a bit like the sort of the father from Friday Night Dinner refusing to wear a shirt.
Yeah. It's just that the era of filmmaking, isn't it? Just like, you know, someone's got to have the top off for a bit.
Yeah.
Just, you know, that's on the checklist.
Yeah, done.
Right, let's move on.
I mean, it is just the sort of, you know, it is really, really interesting when you sort of see, you know, her character, because her character just flits between, you know, at some points being a demon, to being his savior, to somebody who, you know, who takes his picture, his memories and burns them, you know, and it's that sort of like, she's the sort of, you know, she's the person who helps him move between the different levels, I suppose.
Yeah, and but at times she's also so inappropriate. So, like, when she's talking, when he's been...
Yeah.
He's coming out of the fever and he's been talking in his sleep. And she's like, you were talking to your kids, even the dead one. Like, so callous.
Yeah.
So, like, if someone had a child that had died in an accident... It's just not what you would ever say.
No.
No matter how pissed off you are.
And the fact you can't remember the names of his living children.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's just like, oh. But what's really interesting, though, isn't it, is the safest points in the whole film are where, essentially, we are in the non-reality elements of it.
Yeah.
Which is just mind-blowing when you think about it. Because actually, you know, spoiler alert, and I, you know, even with this, so you need to watch it to kind of sort of decipher it, is that actually this is a man who's dying, or is he, or has he gone mad? But we're at the safest point where we are potentially in his unraveling mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is insane. Which is just sort of, is a mind-blowing element to a film that you just sort of, you know, people sort of generally sort of, you know, don't get in the first kind of viewing too often. It's, you know, people, I remember people watching it and just being sort of talking about the shaking heads.
Yeah, yeah. Which has been replicated so many times.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean,
even on Four Lions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that's a great film.
Oh, I love it.
That's a great film. Now, what's interesting about that, all the effects in this film are done in camera.
Wow.
And to get the effect of the guy, particularly where we come to a, you know, later on in the film, Jacob gets grabbed and thrown in a car and told to stop talking about things.
Yeah.
And he escapes and he jumps out of the car, and then he injures his back.
Just to backtrack there, though, he puts up a great fight.
Oh, it's a cracker.
Yeah.
It's an absolute belter.
Kicks some ass.
Yeah, he does. He does. I think I would have just curled up and cried.
But I did notice a bit when he's hanging out the door, out of the car door, and the guy says, you know, shoot this son of a bitch, or whatever he says. I'll kill this son of a bitch.
Yeah.
And then the door opens and he's hanging out, and you can clearly see that the bad guy is holding on to him.
So yes, he doesn't actually fall out of the car. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's holding on for dear life.
Yeah. Now, that, you know, and then he hurts his back, doesn't he?
Yeah.
When he dives out, and he sort of takes him, and he gets taken to that hospital.
Oh, man.
And, like, that scene there where, and again, it, you know, it's a reference to Dante's Inferno going on in there. You've got Bedlam, elements of Bedlam.
Yeah.
And some of the imagery in that is horrid.
It's just awful. It's just, but you cannot take your eyes off it. The way that it's shot.
Yeah.
You know, you've got him on the trolley, you know, an occasional flash of the trolley's wheel, you know.
And how uneven it is.
Yeah, and traversing through the, you know, the blood and the guts, and and then various, again, like you said, biblical characters.
Yeah.
And you've got the people on top, on the netting on top, which I think is kind of, I don't know, I took that as like a nod to the chemical, you know, the chemical war elements of Nam. You know, they're kind of like disfigured, deformed, aren't they?
Well, what happened was Adrian Lin went back and did a lot of research, and he was looking at, and like lots of that scene got inspired by photos of people who suffered thalidomide.
Which is
horrific. Absolutely horrific when you think, but, and like the guy, like the really muscular guy who's like a double amputee.
Yeah.
He is like holding onto the bed and the head is like spinning.
Yeah.
And the way they did that was quite simple. They just had him to shake his head from side to side, and they shot it at 4 frames per second.
And then sped it up.
Well, because obviously the frame, once you drop the frame rate, everything moves quicker anyway. So that's what, you know, and I think this is all pre-CGI.
Yeah.
So none of this is CGI. And like that sort of, where he's, you know, he's in the hospital, it is terrifying. I mean, when I saw this the first time, it frightened the shit out of me. And the fact that, you know, the doctor with no eyes and the needle straight through the middle of the head.
That freaks me out. Have you ever watched the Twilight Zone movie?
Yes.
And there's the girl with no mouth.
Yes.
That scared the hell out of me as a kid. Like, that was like nightmare inducing when I was, when I first watched that. Because that, and the same with this, you know, and it's like a part of the face has just been rubbed out.
Yeah.
I thought, it's really freaky.
Yeah. There is something really awful about that. There is something that is just, I can actually feel the hairs on my neck standing up thinking about it.
Yeah, it's not nice.
No, and like, you know, and then obviously Danny Aiello's character, Lewis, the chiropractor, comes and saves him.
Yeah, it's such a cool bit.
Yes, I love Danny Aiello. I think he's a superb actor.
Yes.
And he's amazing at losing his temper.
Yeah. It might just be a very angry man.
Yeah, he could very well be, you know. But he's just really, really good at losing his temper. And like the sort of, like that opening scene where he goes and has his back treated and he refers to him as, has anybody told you, as sort of, you're like a cherub, like an overgrown cherub.
Yeah.
And it's, and again, it's quite clear that he is, you know, he is the angel that saves him and pulls him out to that. And then you get that speech about letting go and those things.
Well, the big thing for me in the hospital scene when he's with the freaky doctors is, and there's a lot of this throughout the film. They basically tell him, you know, you're dead. This is not where you really are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when he's talking to the palm reader.
Yes. In the party,
she says, you know, this line on your palm says that you're already dead.
Yeah.
And that's and then I think there's the chats with Danny Aiello.
Yeah. Well, throughout he keeps asking. Yeah. He keeps asking, "Am I dead?
Yeah.
Am I dead? Yeah. And they keep, you know. And it's interesting that Jesse says, "No, you're not dead." And everybody else says, "You're dead."
Yeah.
And you know, in his sort of, and then when he has his dreams, when he flits back to his family, where he's with his wife and everything else, and his wife is like the complete opposite. She's caring, she's nurturing, she's soft. And again, she's saying, you know, she never answers the question that you're not dead.
Yeah.
She just cries.
And do you know what's absolutely phenomenal in this film and heart-wrenching? His real, you know, it's a fantastic performance by Tim Robbins. His despair, absolute, you know, heartbreaking despair when he thinks that he sees Gabe.
Yes.
And it's conveyed so well. It's just, it's an amazing piece of acting.
Yeah. And at no point, because it could quite easily slip into melodrama and, you know, you could get a fair bit of ham in you if you wanted to. But again, all the performances in this, and Tim Robbins is just, he's perfect in it. He's absolutely perfect in it because, you know, I got to be honest, I'd probably be screaming the place down. If, you know, if I was just seeing not even a quarter of what he sees in this.
I'd be rocking in the corner, sucking my thumb.
Yeah. You know, I think, the moment where I saw somebody without a face waving at me from a train, he'd be like, right, I'm out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Done.
You win. I don't care. I'm out.
Call 111. Call the NHS. What appears to be the problem?
Yeah, I've gone mental.
Yeah, please help me.
I seem to be trapped at some point between the physical and the metaphysical. Help me. Yeah. I'm having an existential crisis. Have you washed your hands?
Yeah, please keep washing your hands.
But it is just that sort of, you know, the fact that he's able to convey this level of hurt. And like, you know, the scenes where when he sat on the edge of his bed, and I got to be honest, I think is you know, either his wife or his girlfriend could have bought him a better dressing gown.
Yes.
Because it's horrific.
It's, yeah.
You know, and
it's a bad outfit.
Yeah, it's not good, is it? It's not even a good colour. And, you know, he's got his little memory box.
Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah, and it's... It's funny that he's got a PhD in philosophy, isn't it?
Yes.
And he's just working on the post.
Yeah. Well, he said, didn't he, after the war, I just didn't want to think anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, you're right.
He says, I just didn't want to think anymore, which is sort of like, which is really interesting in itself. It's that idea that actually not only did the war sort of physically break people, it sort of meant, you know, that idea that it mentally broke people, And again, it goes back to that idea of disconnect, isn't it? That sort of disconnection between people who are, you know, articulate, who, you know, have, you know, really sort of, you know, obviously he's got a PhD, but he's become so disconnected from himself, from humanity and everything else. Just wants to switch that part of his brain off.
Yeah.
Because because it's almost as if, you know, his character sort of, if he switches it back on, he's going to, everything will come flooding back to him.
Yeah. And to follow on from that, should we talk about that opening Vietnam scene?
Yes.
There's the attack is absolutely horrific. Body parts everywhere.
Yes.
Kind of reminded me of Hamburger Hill.
Yeah, it definitely.
Effects wise. Really, really like gory. There's a guy who's, you know, half his leg is
hanging off.
And we think that it's an attack by Viet Cong.
Yes.
They've just been surprised and they're using some kind of nerve toxin, but they've been drugged.
Yeah.
By their own government, and they basically rip each other apart.
And the scene where the chemist who created that drug.
Yeah.
Sort of explains to him what happens. Again, is so well acted.
Yeah, I thought it was a great way to tie together all the fragments of scenes that we'd had up to that point.
Yeah.
And it's one of those.
Yeah.
When a good movie uses dialogue well to, you know, sew everything together.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it's done right. Yeah. All you need is two people stood talking.
Absolutely, absolutely. And even the setting where they're in that sort of rundown, you know, almost abandoned building sort of alleyway.
Yeah.
And Matt Craven does an amazing job with essentially what is exposition, which is, you know, like you said, is just that ability to sort of explain everything.
Yeah.
And then he talks about sort of, you know, they tested it on monkeys first. It's just, and then they tested it on prisoners of war, and then they tested it on them.
It's just amazing script writing, isn't it?
It's superb. And I mean, this film took years to get into production. They tried to get it into production in the 80s, and people just weren't biting. They just didn't want it. I don't think people at that point were ready for it.
Yeah.
And then obviously, they managed to do this. But it also ties into, you know, the fact that at the end of the film, it says that drugs were used on soldiers.
Yeah.
But the government still denies it.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the chilling lines for this is where it says about, you know, they expected the kill rates to be high.
And yeah, so, yeah.
Your kill rates were high, but just on each other.
Yeah.
You know, so it's. You know, it's just, and actually, when you get that flashback and then you see them, killing each other, is awful.
Yeah.
You know, and even when he gets stabbed, where Tim Robbins' character gets bayoneted, the look of shock on both of their faces.
Yeah, yeah, and when you find out that it's his mate, it's his, you know, platoon buddy.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, you know, because we see that scene build and build. We know he gets stabbed quite very early on in the film.
Yeah.
And we see it again and again and again. And you take that shock as, you know, kind of shock at being stabbed.
Yeah.
But it's the shock of surprise.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Over the actual stabbing. It's like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
It's you.
Yeah. And it's like how believable it is. The
yeah.
fact that, you know, there's the other thing as well, the score in this is just wonderful. I'm going to have to track down the soundtrack to this.
Yeah, I've put that in my notes. I need this, hopefully, on vinyl.
It is. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. But at no point does it overwhelm the film.
No, it's... it's so subtle, even at the most, even in the most moving part of the film, it's just kind of like an accompaniment to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think soundtracks have gone a bit mad of late. I watched You Were Never Really There with Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
And that soundtrack has won a lot of rewards. But if you watch that film, that soundtrack completely, it's like a battering ram throughout the movie. It's kind of the, I think they're trying to do a Drive.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they miss the parking spot.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's off.
And I think, like, when it's done well, if you're going to have, like, a massive, I think, you know, obviously, Inception, you know, kicked it all off with the, all really sort of, you know, that sort of that impactful, that kind of feel to it. And then you're sort of, I mean, Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah.
That's just exhausting. Yeah. It's incredible, but it's just exhausting. Yeah. But we then get, you know, this. You get a score like this, which is subtle, and just plays with it, and just floats underneath everything.
Yeah, and even in, a good way of putting it.
And even with its most sort of like, you know, those the scene in the hospital, it's never overpowering. You never get that sort of like hugely, it's never intrusive.
No, never. But you know it's there.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you can feel it. You can definitely feel it. And it's something that I'm definitely going to have to track down. And sort of, because it is just stunning. Absolutely stunning.
Yeah. I would like that in the collection.
Yeah. Yeah.
With some really cool artwork.
Yeah. Now, the other person who popped up in this, is Jason Alexander.
Yes.
As the lawyer.
Yes.
And he's such a dick.
He is. He's fantastic actor.
Oh, he's incredible. He's absolutely, you know, from this to George Costanza to the, you know, The Burning.
Yeah.
He's an incredible actor. But there is something about the characters he plays that you just want to punch him in the face.
Yeah. If you think of like some of his most mainstream stuff, like Shallow Hal.
Yeah.
He's a complete knobhead in that as well.
Yeah. Now, do you know, can you see why, one of the most interesting pieces of trivia I love about this film is, of course, Tim Robbins is 6'5".
Yes.
Jason Alexander is 5'5".
Okay, so we've got a good foot.
Right, so they were, originally, the scene outside the courtroom was going to take place in a single room. Instead, they moved it to take place on the stairs because of the height difference between Tim Robbins and Jason Alexander. Because essentially what would happen is, he would just completely overpower, and no matter what they did with levels or cameras or anything, apart from putting Jason Alexander on a box.
Yeah, I was going to say, couldn't they borrow the Tom Cruise box?
Yeah, well, Tom Cruise now wears heels.
Oh, okay. The box is gone.
So, so that's why they set that scene. And it works amazingly.
Yeah, it does.
It works really, really well because, again, you've got that idea of sort of power and status keeps fluctuating between the two of them. But,
yeah.
A 6'5" or 5'5" in the same scene.
Yeah, well, they did it. They definitely did it well, and that scene's really shocking. As shocking as all, how many elements of this film are shocking because of like gore and, you know, demons popping up and stuff like that. Yeah. That's just shocking because of the escalation of his temper.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because he's trying to stay on the level. He's really trying to stay on the level, and he's not, and he doesn't want to be affected by this. But then he just snaps.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa.
Well, he's completely at, you know, you can see that he's at the end, isn't he? At the end.
And another great thing about this film is it also tempts you with that whole conspiracy element to it. Once you get to that point and he gets kidnapped and everything. And you're like, oh, so, and from that point, you know, you wouldn't be judged on thinking, oh, does he now go on a rampage? You know, does he, you know, take people down to get to the truth?
Yes.
And if Jacob's Ladder went that way from that point,
yeah,
still be a great movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it just sort of, it's that sort of, you know, it feeds to that point that sort of, is it going to take that direction now? Or is this just his, you know, his brain sort of making another leap as it further unfolds? You know, and it's that idea. It's just that's one more thing to torment him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to keep pushing him. Just to sort of just keep him going.
Yeah, and it's harsh because he has that little part where he's got his team together and they're going to work together and they're going to find out what happened. Yeah. Everyone, you know, it's got, things are going good now, you know, it's got backing, and then that lasts for all of like a day and then it's taken away from it.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's so harsh.
It's that sort of like purgatory, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the sort of, it's that limbo and like that idea that, you know, one more way to torture you.
Yeah.
We're just going to sort of, you know, I think John Cleese said it best. And it does sum up education in a number of ways in Clockwork. Where he says,
I love that.
Where he says, it's, you know, it's the hope that kills you. It's not the disappointment. It's the hope that kills you. And it's very true.
I'm just thinking about John Cleese thrashing a cow with a branch now.
Yeah. I mean, Clockwork is, I think it's vastly underrated.
Oh, it's a brilliant film.
It's so vastly underrated. And I get anxious watching him. I get really stressed out. Do you remember Stressed Eric?
Yeah.
I stopped watching the cartoon Stressed Eric because I'd find myself getting really stressed. Which obviously shows that it's, you know, was how long that didn't last too long, did it, Stressed Eric?
No, was it two seasons or a season? It was, yeah, I think it was possibly two, but I'm leaning towards just one.
It's, just love it. It's not the despair, it's the hope that kills you.
Yeah.
And I suppose you could, that's what kind of sums up Tim Robbins' character in this, isn't it? He is just that sort of, he is at that point where you think, oh God, he's got it. He's got it. And then no, he's, it's all taken away from him.
It's like he hopes that he's alive. I mean, if you just say that out loud and you think about it,
yeah,
you know, where his mental state is that he hopes he's alive, but
yeah.
He's not sure.
Yeah.
Which is bleak.
Yes. And I also think the biggest kick in the dick for him is where Santa mugs him.
Yeah.
You can't move, and then he sort of, Santa just comes up and takes his wallet.
Yeah, and then he's in the hospital saying, I was mugged, and I'm like, who mugged you? Yeah. It's like Santa Claus.
Yeah, it's like, okay.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and that's the other thing as well, which it's sort of, you know, another sort of hint, you know, is he alive, is he dead, is there's lots of shots of people standing over him.
Yeah.
There's lots of shots from, you know, taken from his perspective of him flat on his back.
Yeah, like the bath especially.
Yes. Yeah. That scene is just heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. Yeah. You know.
Because he screams out, you're killing me.
Yeah.
Which they must have been doing something in NAM on him then. You know, like, so I don't know. Yeah. I don't know much about, you know, keeping people alive in a field hospital, but you know,
it's
stitching
them
up or something. Yeah, I can imagine. But I think there are parts. I'm definitely going to watch this film again now with the knowledge of what, you know, how it ends.
Yeah.
Because I think there's probably elements that I missed, which are, you know, he's being operated on, or you know, people are trying to keep him alive.
Yeah.
And the one in the bath where he shouts, you're killing me, has got to reflect that in some way. But there must be loads throughout the film.
Yeah.
Where he's, you know, just like when the the chiropractor is moving him around and stuff like that. It is what happens, isn't it? You know, get moving from one place to the next.
It's, I mean, you know, what is the one standout moment for you in this?
There are many. I think the whole thing works so well.
Yeah.
So that for me is one standout. The whole thing, to say it's so fragmented, and you're given so many possible scenarios.
Yeah.
Obviously, the ending really stands out because of what it signifies, and the, you know, the symbolism of it is massive. But it is a victorious ending.
It is, and I think Kim Newman. I'm sure it's Kim Newman, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, Mr. Newman. But I think it was Kim Newman really sort of had a dig at the film for its ending.
Okay.
And again, I had a bit of an unfair pop at Macaulay Culkin. Where they said that they felt that he was overly sentimental and saccharine, which I thought, I think it's fair to say this guy has been through enough.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that the person, you know, the one sort of ray of light in his entire life is the person that gets to guide him up the ladder and up those stairs should be his son. And considering what Macaulay Culkin was, I think maybe 8.
Yeah, if that, yeah.
When he made this film, I think he does a bloody good job.
I think he's very good at it.
I think he's superb. I think this and The Good Son are my two favourite Macaulay Culkin films.
Yep, not Home Alone 2.
Oh. Do you know what? I love Home Alone 1. It's great. And having sat through Home Alone 2 now pretty consistently for the last 15 years at Christmas towards the end of term, it's like Forrest Gump. I fucking hate Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Only because at one point my office was next door. And I shouldn't probably be saying this, but somebody, you know, a member of staff was using it to illustrate American history.
Okay.
And for the number of years that I was in my office, I know every word to Forrest Gump.
I think it's a brilliant single watch movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
But not. There's something about it that doesn't. I don't want to watch it again.
No.
I don't know why that is. I haven't kind of given it much thought. I'm glad I enjoyed it when I watched it. I watched it in the cinema.
Yeah.
I don't want to watch it again.
Yeah, no, I don't ever want to watch it again. It is one of those things where you just think, enough now, thank you very much. But
thanks, move on.
For a period of time, I think I've developed the Inspector in the Pink Panther, where he's got a little tick.
Yeah.
When anytime somebody mentions Clouseau, it's sort of, if your life is like a box of chocolate, it's like,
back to the good films. I thought this whole film, when you get to the end and you realise the actual story, it's only two ways it can go.
Yeah.
He goes to heaven or he goes to hell.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to ask yourself, are they flashbacks or flash forwards that he's experiencing?
Yeah.
And is it a look, if he survives, does he return to New York, doesn't reconnect with his wife? He lives with this Jezebel, which is, very telling, the name that's used.
Yeah.
He has a mundane job, nothing goes right for him. Or if he dies and he accepts that, and he accepts, he washes a, you know, it's like baptism, isn't it? He
yes.
washes away his guilt. And then, you know, the gates of heaven are open to him.
Yeah.
And
yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think, yeah, so I, for me, it was, I did think they're flash forwards. I think, he, you know, the actual, what actually happens in this film is Tim Robbins is injured, Jacob Singer is injured in Vietnam because of a horrific chemical experiment. He's being operated on in a field hospital. You know, he's very close to death.
Mm.
And he's kind of probably in and out of, you know, cognitive thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just like your life, people say, you know, your life flashes before you.
Yeah.
And I think the general interpretation of that is that it's your past life.
But yes.
The take on this is that it's just life that's flashing before him is its potential future.
Yes. Yeah.
And then there's elements of, you know, witnessing what hell would be like, you know, and I kind of get that he's being pulled by forces beyond his control.
Yes.
And if he in this period of limbo, if he gives in to his guilt, then he's going downstairs, basically.
Yeah.
But if he continues to fight and attempts to work out what's going on and rid himself of his guilt, as you know, Danny Ayo's character explains to him, basically guides him to do that anyway. So I agree, like the angel point of view.
Yeah,
he's clearly his guiding angel.
Yeah,
his guardian. So it's kind of when you piece it all together. You know, he's dying. His life is flashing before him, and yeah, he kind of lets go and travels up Jacob's ladder.
Yes,
into heaven.
And it's that sort of, you know, it's that sort of, he has been through the journey, he's been shown everything, and
yeah.
Now that he's made peace with it, that he's been through it, and that he can finally let it all go. He can move on. And it's sort of, I suppose in some ways it's quite a sort of, almost sort of, it's quite existential, isn't it? That idea of that, you know, you sort of look at it from a sort of, from a Buddhist point of view, is that all life is suffering, and that once, in order for us to move on from it, we must accept it and then leave it behind and leave all our baggage behind, and then we can free ourselves from it. And I suppose his sort of near-death experience, like you said, is a flash forward. It's that idea for him to sort of go take, you know, see what can happen to him and then make the choices. You know, if it was Bullseye, it's like, this is what you could have won.
Yeah.
And it's really shit.
Yeah.
So the best thing you could probably do is let it go.
Yeah,
and, you know, and I think it's, you know, this is a film that terrifies me for a number of reasons, but at the same time, it leaves you with hope.
Yeah,
because I think, you know, if it didn't, it would be the bleakest film.
Yeah,
it would just, honestly, it would be just so unrelentingly bleak.
Yeah, I think if it did end with him, you know, I don't know, either remaining in purgatory or going to hell. I think you just have to find Tim Robbins and give him a hug.
Yeah, you would, wouldn't you? You'd have to say, look, I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry. And the part of it is, none of it's his fault.
No.
None of it is his fault.
Just a soldier in the wrong platoon.
Absolutely. Oh, do you know what's interesting? The number on his sort of honorable discharge is actually the number that appears on it is on his certificate of service is US 21719 365. I haven't memorized this. I'm not that nerdy. It's just I found this bit of trivia really interesting.
Okay.
Is that that discharge plate papers belong to a real service person called Thomas Wright, who became the props master for Jacob's Ladder. So he used his own service number for
that's
the
cool.
scene where the discharge certificate. And it's just there for a second. I thought that's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that's really cool.
That is there. So Here we go. How would you score this one out of 10?
I'm going to go 8.5.
I think that's spot on. It's an 8.5. It's an absolute 8.5. And I think probably some days it could even be a 9.
Yeah.
But no, I think 8.5 is absolute, because, you know, I don't think it's perfect, but it's a bloody, bloody good film, and it's certainly in my top 10.
Absolutely.
It's certainly in my top 10. It's a great film. Absolutely great film.
I think a good solid 8.5. There are elements of it maybe a bit slow, a bit unnecessary.
Yeah.
But you can forget about those.
It's
a very, very well shot, well made film. Just, I'm really pleased that you said let's cover Jacob's Ladder, and I was obviously aware of it. But I'm so glad that I watched it for the first time today, and now had this time with you to chat about it. Because it's just, you know, my head is spinning with the elements of it. So it's so good to, you know, it's like therapy.
Yes.
I'm getting it out.
Yeah, it is a mind altering film. It is just an absolute total brain, you know, it is like having somebody stick a fork in and scramble it round. I think I was 14 when I sat down and watched it for the first time. Didn't get it in any way, shape, or form. It just frightened the shit out of me. And then it's taken a lot of viewings sort of since to sort of come back. But it's a classic film.
It's a gem. Yeah, it's a genre defining psychological horror. I'm eager to watch it again.
Yeah.
With the knowledge that I now have, now that I've you know, been through the journey beginning to end.
Yes.
Just to see what, you know, pick up on what I probably missed. I probably missed loads, but yeah, great film. So thanks for the recommendation.
It's one of those things where you do pick up, like all great films, you get to go back and pick up new stuff on it.
So, yeah.
Well, there we are, my friend.
Cool.
We've done nearly an hour and 20.
We're getting good at this.
We are. We're definitely, you know, we're picking up speed.
Yeah.
My friend, thank you so much for coming on. And I'm really, really glad you enjoyed it. I'm really glad.
Thanks for the recommendation. Loved it.
Thanks
for having me on again.
Oh, no problem at all. And we'll get you back soon.
Will
get you back very, very soon. Now, you take care, my friend.
You too, mate. Look after yourself.
I will. Stay safe. As always, I want to say a big thank you to my co-host, Darren, for being on. Honestly, it's such a pleasure having him on. And to talk about such a great film like Jacob's Ladder, it's one of my, like I said, it's one of my all-time favourites, and it's a superb, superb film. Okay, up next we have got What the Wookiee Watched. And first up we have got The First Power from 1990. Let's check out the trailer.
Since the beginning of time, Satan has worked to create the perfect killer. One who kills many without reason. One who cannot be stopped. Today, that man exists. Be warned.
We're just going to go through a very small door here.
Lou Diamond Phillips is hunting a man who kills for the sake of killing. Tracy Griffith might be the only one who can help stop him.
I know where he's going next.
But this location fits the pentagram pattern on the map, and my informant says this is where he's going to strike next.
This is the third time in less than 5 years that Logan has been responsible for the death or capture of a serial killer.
See you around, buddy boy.
I doubt it.
Each death makes him stronger.
How did you know where he was going next?
I opened myself up to him. You might have executed his body, but his spirit has been released.
He has the third power. He could be anywhere.
How's the stomach, buddy boy?
He has the second power.
Hey, cutie.
He could be anyone.
Sister.
Oh, I'm afraid she's not here.
Now, he has the first power.
See you around, buddy boy.
Immortality.
You don't have any idea of what you'd be facing.
First power.
Okay, that was the trailer for The First Power from 1990. The First Power was directed by Robert Resnikoff. It was also written by Robert Resnikoff. It stars La Bamba himself, Lou Diamond Phillips, Tracy Griffith, Jeff Coba, who's superb in this. He's one of my all-time favourite psychopaths in any film. McKelty Williamson, lots of people remember him as Bubba from Forrest Gump. It also stars Elizabeth Arryn, Dennis Lipscomb. Now, I rented this when I was about 11, and I fell in love with it. I just thought it was absolutely superb. What I absolutely love about this is Jeff Coba's character, the second that he becomes this free roaming spirit, I suppose, possessing, jumping from body to body. he suddenly becomes like this parkour gymnastics martial arts expert. It's absolutely fantastic. It's so silly. This has got a fantastic car chase. There's an amazing, like almost like a water slide finale kind of finish to this film. It's completely bonkers. Lou Diamond Phillips is wonderful in this. He's absolutely wonderful in this. I think it's an absolute... It feels sort of... How can I say? It's very, very nostalgic going back and watch this. Is it a perfect film? God, no. It's very entertaining. It's an hour and a half. It flies by. It's very well made. It is a wonderful slice of 90s serial killer movie. If you like films like Silent Rage, films of that ilk, I mean, Fallen did it. I think it was Fallen with Denzel Washington. The sort of body jumping, sort of demonic serial killer type movie. Like Split Second, even again, lots of those sort of type movies. Genuinely, I really, really enjoyed this film. Looking at it now in the hard light today, 88 Films have got a fantastic Blu-ray release of this, by the way. I'd give it a 7.5 out of 10. Okay, up next, we have got, from 1985, Cut and Run. Let's check out the trailer.
Civilization has introduced countless evils to this mysterious jungle, but not terror. Because here, terror was born. And here, terror will live. As long as outsiders dare to enter the savage wilderness, two reporters stumble into a troubled paradise. Wind up running for their lives.
We can't just sit here, Mark. We'd be asking for it.
Because beneath the sheer beauty lies a world of utter madness. Today's headlines erupt in a timeless thriller.
Your journey ends here. Forever.
Cut and Run,
It's the one story you won't see on the 6 o'clock news.
That was the trailer for Cut and Run from 1985. Cut and Run was directed by the legendary Ruggiero Deodato, of course, the man behind Cannibal Holocaust. It was also written by, I think he had a hand in the screenplay. It was also written by Cesar Frugoni. Now, this was actually based on an unmade Wes Craven film. However, when the original funding for this fell through, the Italian production company kept the script and came up with the idea for Cut and Run. And like our last film, the plot is not particularly clear from the trailer that I just played you. And essentially what we have here, we've got a cameraman, we've got a reporter, they get in contact with one of the leaders of Jonestown who survived, and they go down into the deepest, darkest jungle and realize that they've stumbled into the middle of a drug war. This stars Lisa Blount, Leonard Mann, William Amis, the fantastic Richard Lynch, who's had his sneer in Best in This, Eric LaSalle, who also starred in Jacob's Ladder, and the wonderful Michael Berryman. This film is insane. I think the original production company behind this wanted another Cannibal Holocaust from Deodato, but he came up with this instead. Is this him turned up to 11? No. However, it's pretty nasty at times. The VHS cover and the poster art for this are things of magnificence. You need to look them up if you can, because they're absolutely fantastic. And it was one of the posters that was up in the local video shop as a kid, and I always remember seeing the VHS and being a little bit too sort of afraid to get it out, because it kind of felt a little bit illicit. This film has got a few issues. There's a brilliant moment at the start of this where after you have like the initial attack on these sort of drug smugglers by these native these sort of headhunters, I suppose, led by Michael Berryman. You get this scene where this woman is smuggling drugs into the country, and she's got this, and she's on a train, and they clearly haven't told anybody that they're going to be filming, and you can see all the people looking directly at the camera and sort of trying to hide from it. It's wonderful. If you get that moment, it's absolutely fantastic. It's worth watching the film for this. That being said, this is a lot of fun, and if like me, you like your Italian horror, go and check it out. It's worth it. It's, you know, in truth be told, it's a 6.5 out of 10. You know, it doesn't have the sort of the meanness of Cannibal Holocaust, but then not many things do. But it's well worth checking out. So, ladies and gentlemen, our time together has drawn to an end. I just want to say, honestly now, please, please stay safe. Keep washing your hands. Make sure you are following the guidance out there. Make sure you're still following the social distancing. I know it's hard. I know it's bored when we're indoors, but please, please do that. You know, if not for yourselves, but think of others. Now, take care. I will be back with another episode very, very soon. So while we're all going through this, I will try and make sure that we keep pumping out the episodes for you. So, in the immortal words of Count Dracula, good night out there, whatever you